At this time, the ham radio operators in the New York City area gather for something they call the Technical Net. It's a meeting of the clan in which ham radio operators do the best they can to teach each other how all this complicated hardware works and how to work it better, how to understand it, how to get more enjoyment out of the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM 2-meter repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 25 kinds. And you might want to, from time to time, at least listen to or maybe even experiment with some of the other 24 or 25 kinds. The guys who do DXing and the guys who do meteor scatter and moon bounce and satellite work and so on, they're all on television transmission, ham radio television transmission, fast scan or slow scan. Talk to each one of those groups, and they're having a grand old time. And they'll say, come on aboard. Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, and Dick, K2RIW, we try to serve as moderators. We try to bring this crowd together and give it a little bit of control. We don't always succeed. There are times we get answers that are too short, too long. Can't please everybody. We know that. We make an attempt and express your opinions. We'll take them into consideration and try to correct some of the errors that we make from time to time. You're not going to get perfect information here. Occasionally, there's going to be errors. And when those errors are pointed out, that's the scientific process, so to speak. Call it peer review, if you like. When the errors get pointed out, we all become a little bit smarter. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And there's what you're not supposed to do. Every minute or so, you're supposed to interrupt and make sure the machine gets a chance to reset. Not supposed to be long-winded like I am. After 27 and a half years, this net began in September of 1982. That's 27 and a half years ago. After this much time, covering this much area of the northeastern New Jersey, southern New York State, southwestern Connecticut, much of Long Island, you cover that much of the New York City area. By now, after 27 years, we believe there are people listening. It doesn't have to be pointed out to us. So please check in, mostly if you really do have a question or a comment, and give us that name, your call letters, and the word yes, which means that's what you're saying. Give me your call letters and name and that word yes right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
November to X-ray, Juliet, November, Wesley, yes.
Wesley recognized. Anyone else?
RYY, yes.
Joe recognized. Anyone else?
KC2SYL, the name is Bill, yes.
KEY, good evening all.
Now, Bill is 3 and Mel is 4, okay? Wonder if Mel's going to have a question or a comment for us tonight. I'm having fun with him. So far, we've got Wesley, Joe, Bill, and Mel. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes at this time. K2RIW. Okay, that could be it for right now. That's more than enough to get started. Wesley, as you guys know, is assembling one hell of a good testing and scientific electronic testing laboratory in Queens. He's been collecting equipment. He's going to start making, he's already started making some measurements, trying to confirm or deny certain beliefs that people have about electronics and rotary machines with strong magnetic fields and Tesla coil-like things. So he's of the belief that it's time that these somewhat forgotten areas get reinvestigated because there's more to be had there. So I wonder how that effort is going, Wesley. I ran into a little bit of a website that was somewhat interesting and sent you an email on that subject today. M2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, M2XJN. Well, I believe the mission is accomplished right now. I'm just waiting for the devices to come to my house. Spectrum analyzer, I've got one. It's Advantis. Color screen, TFT. Network analyzer, hollow screen, TFT, Atlantis, and the impedance analyzer with phase, and it's the Hewlett-Packard, 131948. So I believe I have all of the things that I wanted to have, and I'm going to stop at this point to purchasing maybe some features for this device. I think for the educational purposes, let me drop. It would be good just to repeat a few subjects again for the ham radio operators, a very easy, very simple way. What is S parameter, how to set up the bench for that, and how to measure that, and what to use for it. The same story is with the Smith chart and polar. As you mentioned many times, that this is very much useful to take this kind of measurement. Back to you, Dick, and to again.
Very fine, Wesley. I believe you're operating from your house, not from your car. I noticed that on the input you're on 146.255, and your audio sounds very clean. There's some kind of an unusual propagation characteristic happening between Wesley's antenna and this particular repeater. When he's on the exact correct frequency, 146.25, it has a multi-pass sound to it during certain portions of the day. And today, he's recently discovered that when he goes to 5 KC high on transmit, but normal receive, his audio sounds clean. There are people blaming it on his Kenwood 2000. I don't think so. I think it's an unusual propagating condition. I've seen something similar to that happen on 432 single sideband from time to time over the years. Okay, let me drop. Scattering parameters are what S stands for. S parameters are scattering parameters. Scattering really means that when a radio signal is propagating through some kind of a medium, it could be a transmission line, coaxial cable, it could be a twin lead transmission line, it could be a piece of waveguide, or the radio signal could be propagating through free space. But when a signal goes through a medium, and if the medium changes in any way, in the case of coaxial cable, there could be a sudden jump in the outside diameter, which means there's a new characteristic impedance. Or somebody could have pinched the cable in a certain spot, and the cable is being squeezed together in that area, acting like a stray capacitance. There could be a change of materials. The end of the transmission line could hit an antenna or any other kind of a load device. So when there is any kind of a change in the characteristic impedance, the velocity factor, the capacitance per and picofarad per foot, the inductance per foot, and any change in the parameters that the signal is propagating through when it's going through that medium will create scattering. Let me drop. Scattering means, and by the way, in the case of a signal propagating through free space on, say, for instance, 10 gigahertz, when the signal hits a cloud, the cloud has a different characteristic impedance than free space because the water vapor has a very high dielectric constant, so the cloud is a more dense medium radio-wise than the rest of the dry air around it. So the signal gets scattered by the cloud. Scattered means some of the signal reflects back in the direction where it came from. Some of the signal with slight attenuation goes through. Some of it goes off at other angles, scattering. So in order to define scattering with reference to closed circuit systems, in other words, systems that are confined by way of waveguide, transmission line, and so on, they have these scattering parameters. And they're given a number, S11, S21, S22, S21, S12. The first number, and they got it backwards, in my opinion, when they came up with the numbering system. These two numbers, which are subscripts of the capital letter S, the first number represents what is the output terminal, and the second number represents what is the input terminal. So if I'm testing a amplifier, and I label the input connector terminal number 1 and the output terminal number 2, and I want to know what is the gain of the amplifier, gain would be defined as output divided by input in magnitude as a vector. So So output is on terminal number 2, input is on terminal number 1, and the output is the one you label first. So forward gain of an amplifier would be called S21. To me, it's opposite of common sense. I would have called it S12. Where you apply the signal out, I would have made that the first, and where you take the signal out, I would have called that the second. But that's just the way they did it. So S21 is forward gain, S12 is reverse gain.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If I apply the signal to the output terminal, and I'm feeding the amplifier backwards, which is a very valid thing to do, I want to know the reverse gain of that amplifier. That would be S12. Forward gain is S21. The reason why you want to know the reverse gain is because if the forward gain is, let me pick a number, 20 decibels of forward gain. If the reverse gain is, let me pick a number, 17 decibels of loss. Notice that the magnitude of loss is not as big as the magnitude of gain. The forward gain is plus 20 decibels. The reverse gain is minus 17 decibels. By the way, minus in decibels means that the signal is becoming smaller. If the signal was unity, if in other words, the input and output gain was identical, a very short piece of cable, for instance, would have a S21 of unity. Unity would be 0 decibels. I know it sounds crazy. That's just the way decibels work. 0 decibels means no change in magnitude. Positive decibels means the signal got bigger. Negative decibels mean the signal got smaller. So the reverse gain, if the reverse gain is smaller than the forward gain is larger, that's what I mean by 17 dB of loss, negative 17 dB, and positive 20 dB of gain, that amplifier potentially can oscillate, depending on what the load is. If the load is a highly absorptive signal, like a 50 ohm dummy load, let me drop, then a signal flows through your amplifier, gets 20 dB stronger, hits the 50 ohm dummy load, none of it reflects, and therefore the amplifier doesn't get the opportunity to oscillate. However, in this particular example, if my reflection from my device, my load, was minus 3 dB, and the amplifier has a reverse gain of minus 17 dB, that means the total reflectant plus reverse path would be minus 20. The forward gain is plus 20. Depending on the phase angle of the reflection from that amplifier, I might break that whole system into oscillation. That would be called a conditionally stable amplifier system. So that's one of the things that you can devise among many other things out of S parameters when they're properly calibrated and properly measured. There's two more S parameters I'm going to mention. Let me drop. If I apply signal to the input port, and I want to know, because of standing wave ratio, what is the amount of reflected power or voltage from the input port, that is called S11. The first one means who is the output, port number 1. The second one means who is the input, port number 1. I'm measuring reflection on the input connector of that amplifier. If I want to measure the reflected power characteristic or the VISWR of the output connector, I'd be applying my signal generator and my network analyzer, so to speak, to the output connector and measuring the reflection from the output connector. That would be called S22. When you assemble the whole matrix of 4 S parameters, S11, S21, S12, and S22, when you assemble that whole array of 4 and you do the right mathematical operation on them, you can derive stability circles, you can derive gain characteristics, you can measure something about noise figure, you can optimize the noise figure, optimize the gain, optimize the stability. When you know the S parameters of your first stage, your first transistor, and maybe your amplifier contains 2 separate transistors, and you know the S parameters of transistor number 1, and you know the S parameters of transistor number 2, and you're going to put these together in an amplifier, a smart person knowing those S parameters knows exactly how to make the impedance matching network, the coupling network, that takes the output from the first transistor inside your amplifier, applies it properly to the second amplifier inside your amplifier. Maybe some filtering takes place there at the same time to make sure your amplifier also has a band pass characteristic. So modern day transistors, S parameters are the most popular method of doing it. In the old days, there used to be hybrid parameters. The hybrid parameters for measuring transistors used to be done by putting short circuits and open circuits on the transistors to make the measurement. To put a short circuit on the output when you're measuring current drain of a transistor was a very logical thing to do. And to put an open circuit on the input when you're measuring reverse voltage gain was a very logical thing to do. There's a problem. Let me drop. As the manufacturers of transistors got smarter and smarter, starting in the late 50s, they soon recognized that the most popular ways of measuring a transistor, alpha gain, beta gain, reverse voltage transfer ratio, those are the so-called hybrid parameters, H parameters. They soon realized that as they made the transistors work better and better at higher and higher frequencies, the so-called microwave transistors, you put a short circuit on there in order to try to measure the forward current gain, which is called beta, and the transistor would break into oscillation. A really good microwave transistor, you think you're putting a short circuit on it. You've got a certain lead length between the real inner package of the transistor, the real die that's inside. It's got certain gold-bonded leads inside there that come to the outside lead of the package. And as short as you possibly can do it, you create a short circuit on the outside of the package. As far as the transistor is concerned, at its microwave frequency, that lead length inside is an eighth wavelength long. And he says, gee, that's a beautiful inductor. I'm going to oscillate on that. So you can see that the hybrid parameters didn't work when it comes to microwave transistors. All S parameters of rating transistors and amplifiers and antennas and whatever is done with pure 50-ohm loads. When you measure the S parameters of a transistor, you're really measuring it with every terminal of the transistor terminated with a pure 50-ohm resistor, DC to light, so to speak. Yes, the transistor may not want to see a 50-ohm load. Maybe it gives best gain at a 1,000-ohm load. And maybe it gives best input gain with a 3-ohm load. And you're putting a 50-ohm load on the source, on the input, and you're putting a 50-ohm load on the output. Let me drop. But that's the way the transistor, by definition, will be stable. No transistor in a pure 50-ohm load like that that's well-made can oscillate. You measure these S parameters. Once you use the right mathematics on the S parameters, you'll immediately discover that if you made the output load 1,000 ohms, you're going to get maximum gain, and if you make the input load 3 ohms, you're going to get maximum transfer, and again, maximum gain. So even though you're measuring it with a 50-ohm load, the magic of those S parameters and the four, the way the four parameters can be combined, you'll immediately discover exactly what load, what reactants the transistor wants to seize to give you best performance, whether it be best gain, best noise figure, best dynamic range, best third order intermodulation. By the way, those are all different loads. Let me drop. So as you can tell, S parameters are a very valuable thing to do. One of the things that I forgot to mention right now is that all of these S parameters, all four of those numbers, are not just pure magnitude. Up till now, I've kept it simple, and I told you that in my example, I've got an amplifier with 20 decibels of gain and 17 decibels of reverse gain. I'm telling you its magnitude. Every one of the S parameters is a vector. Vector just really means it's got a magnitude and a phase angle. So my particular transistor may have a forward gain of 20 decibels, and it may have 180 degrees of phase shift at the center operating frequency where I'm making the measurement between the input connector and the output connector. It has 180 degrees of phase shift and 120 decibels of gain, which is 100-to-1 power ratio, by the way. Another amplifier I measure might have 5 degrees of phase shift from input and output and 20 decibels of gain. So you can see that two amplifiers with the exact same amount of gain in certain circumstances behave differently once you understand the S parameters. Because the S parameters are measured as a vector, a voltage with a phase angle to it, that gives you the ability to display it as a polar diagram. That means a polar diagram, 0 volts is a dot in the center of the screen. There's a circle around that which represents unity magnitude. So if my S parameter happened to be 1.0 at 180 degrees of phase shift, that would be a polar diagram display of an arrow going from the center to the left-hand side of the polar diagram, and it would go all the way out to the perimeter. That represents 180 degrees of phase shift to the left, 0 degrees of phase shift on the right, and in between there's a... I'm describing a polar diagram which happens to be nearly identical to a Smith chart. Believe it or not...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you ask your network analyzer to give you a polar display, that's the usual way you display gain. When you're measuring S-parameter of reflection, standing wave ratio, S11 or S22, you can ask for a polar diagram if you like, but if you're a little bit smarter, you say, don't display it as a polar diagram, display it as a Smith chart. The Smith chart is identical to the polar diagram. You just put different grid lines across the screen. The grid lines on a Smith chart represent resistive components and reactive components, but a smart person looking at a polar display, which is just a different kind of grid, would know it's the exact same information. So once you're measuring magnitude and phase angle, you have the ability, if you want to, display it as a polar diagram, and that's what a Smith chart is. You properly view the Smith chart display of the S parameters of your particular transistor. It gives you a tremendous amount of information. It gives you a megabyte of information in 1 second of view with your eye looking at the Smith chart display if you've got enough experience. It gives you a tremendous amount of information in one swell swoop, if you know what I mean. This is the beginning of the questions you're asking, Wesley. Darn good question. And right in the middle of what the TechNet is supposed to be covering. N2XJN, if you need some fills on this, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Can I say something, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Mel. Have I gone too long already?
Oh, but I know it's going to be a lot of confusion. They're going to say, what in the heck you guys talking about now? So let me just say simply, to begin to understand what is the S-curve, I'll make it very simple. If you had a perfect linear amplifier, the output signal would be an exact replica of the input signal. This is what we start with the S-curve. Let me just say that so they'll get an idea what the heck we're talking about, over.
You're absolutely right, Mel. Mel, because of the way propagation is working tonight, or the noise figure of the machine, you are 50% noise, 50% audio. Beautiful, clean audio, but quite a bit of noise. So you're either going to have to go a little bit higher in power output to sound good, or aim a little bit more antenna at the repeater, if that's possible. What Mel is talking about is that when you apply a signal to an amplifier, and you're making any of these S parameter measurements, if you're a smart enough person, you're making the signal small enough that the amplifier is behaving in a thoroughly linear manner. When you make the signal large enough, I don't care if it's your afterburner amplifier or if it's your low noise preamplifier that you connect to the antenna or whatever, every amplifier has a limitation. You make the input signal loud enough, the amplifier goes into some kind of non-linear characteristic. It might start generating square waves instead of sine waves, even though you're putting in a sine wave. It might start flat topping. It might start creating third-order intermodulation distortion if you're doing a two-tone test. So S-parameters are only defined for linear performance. However, in the last year or so, there have been a series of articles in Microwave Theory and Techniques, division of the IEEE, where they've come up with a new set of mathematics that handles the situation of non-linear performance as parameter measurements. We won't go there. Just in passing, we'll mention that. There's probably a few other things you should clear up, Mel, on what I've said so far and the confusion I made. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Exactly, because I know this gets very... This is a little bit more difficult, you know, for people to understand. But just to reiterate that in the perfect linear amplifier, the output signal that you are getting is going to be an exact replica of the input signal. Let me say what else. Usually the curve, as Dick was saying, what you are looking at is usually known as the exponential type shape. And the signal condition is actually held to small values when they are operating, especially a tube below its maximum output. And the ideal situation, what you're doing is trying to what we call centering the operation of the linear portion of the characteristic curve. I hope I said that simple enough. In other words, you're trying to get this thing, the amplifier, to work in the best possible condition. And we basically refer to that in the amplifiers, linear amplifiers and all that, it's still running with two, known as the EG IP curve. But that's getting a little deeper into it. But basically, just remember that we're trying to get the best from the in to look like the out. But I guess maybe that's the best word to use, Dick. Go ahead.
You're right on, Mel. Whenever you line up a linear amplifier, when you go through the proper alignment procedure, one of the first steps you're supposed to do is to set the standby bias current, plate current. The amplifier is close to class A amplification. That means the current is flowing through the tube or the transistor for full 360 degrees of the sine wave of input signal. The current continuously flows, just goes up and down in magnitude in order for the amplifier to do its thing. That's class A. In order to get proper class A amplification out of your amplifier so that the input signal and the output signal displayed on an oscilloscope look identical, except the output is bigger than the input. The whole reason you're using amplifier in the first place. You want the output to be bigger. I've got a 1-watt source of signal. I apply it to my amplifier. I want 100 watts to come out of it. That would be 100 decibel, 100 to 1 gain amplifier, 20 decibels if you express it in decibels instead of power gain, the 100 to 1 ratio. That's just two different ways of saying the same thing. And I want that output signal that's 10 times bigger in voltage, 100 times bigger in power. I want it to have the exact same shape. In order for that to happen, you have to set the proper standby bias current. Maybe your linear amplifier manufacturer told you to set it for 100 milliamps of standby plate current. That's placing your tube in the middle of its dynamic range so that now the plate current is capable of going up and down without flat topping on the way up and without running to zero on the way down, and give you a beautiful sine wave coming out for the sine wave you came putting in. And also, you have to properly adjust the tuning and loading controls, maybe on the input, but certainly on the output of tube amplifiers, in order to make all that happen. When we're discussing S parameters and a network analyzer use, yes,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
That was Wesley's original question. I will admit that only a small percentage of the guys listening to me right now really want to know that. This is one of the fine points of higher level testing with modern day equipment, S parameters. It's a good thing to know. Don't be turned off by the fact that occasionally we get into information that something is not exactly what you want to know. It's good to hear it even though you don't use it. My wife used to teach in a one-room schoolhouse, grades 1 through 8, in Leavenworth, Kansas. That's way back in the dark ages of the late 60s. And she rapidly found out that the second grade students sat there listening to what was going on in the same one-room school when she was teaching the eighth graders. And some of the second graders would say, boy, I'm looking forward to that eighth grade when I get there. That was interesting sounding information. A certain percentage of the students would say that. By the same token, when we amateurs are hearing somebody discussing something a little bit above and beyond where we are today, don't completely reject it. When you hear it enough times, it's going to start making some sense. And in many cases, it's valuable information, even though you didn't think you needed it. You'd be amazed how many things you'll eventually learn that in the beginning you say, I don't need that. Half the courses I took in college, I said, why the heck do I have to waste all this time learning all this material, going through all these tests, and living with all this grief of learning all this material? Well, at least half of those courses that I thought were useless, I suddenly discovered, man, are they useful. And I just didn't know at the time. So a little bit of that's going on. Back to you, Wesley, for some fills on what you've heard so far. N2XJN, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Sure that this information is not going to be used by some people. Let me give you the example. The poor man amplifier, very easy to be made, is the antenna tuner for $200, $150 that you have. And all you got to do is add the model, a cube. You don't need many elements into that. Actually, you don't need any elements. You need the tube and power supply. And actually, that circuitry of the antenna tuner gives you the rest of the amplifier. Now, the second thing, KC2WGB. John, he's got the spectrum analyzer. And a poor man, network analyzer, is spectrum analyzer with the generator, the tracking generator. And here's what I'm going to ask you for. He's got a spectrum analyzer and a network analyzer in one. In my fancy spectrum analyzer from Advantage, I don't have a module for tracking generator. And the question then is, does the frequency of the tracking generator has to be in line, coordinated with the spectrum analyzer, like it is right now in John's machine? Or I can have just a sweeping generator, and it will serve the same way. Back to you, Dick and Jim.
Yeah, very good. A spectrum analyzer is a kind, at least a majority of spectrum analyzer, or a kind of scanning receiver. I can set my spectrum analyzer to scan from 100 megacycles to 200 megacycles. 100 megacycles would be the left-hand side of the screen. 200 megacycles would be the right-hand side of the screen. If any signal applied to the front panel of the spectrum analyzer fell within that frequency region, it would make a vertical deflection on that screen, and the place where the vertical deflection took place would be at the frequency. If I plugged in a signal of 150 megacycles, halfway between 100 and 200, there would be a vertical line of pip on the screen in the middle, halfway from left side to right side, representing 150 megacycles, and the height of that signal would tell you its strength. And if you zoom in on that middle signal by changing the scan width of the spectrum analyzer, I could then, with proper setting, find out, are there sidebands? And by recognizing the shape and the characteristic shape of those sidebands, I'd know immediately, is that signal FM modulated, AM modulated, AM modulated with one tone, two tones, modulated with a square wave, and so on. There's a certain spectral signature you'll recognize on that screen when you acquire some skill, where that spectrum analyzer is telling you the nature of the signal, how strong, how wide it modulates, how far up and down it goes in amplitude modulation, how far left and right, so to speak, it goes in frequency modulation. Properly set the controls, the spectrum analyzer will tell you all that information. If I now buy the auxiliary piece of equipment that many spectrum analyzers have, let me drop, which is called a tracking signal generator, now as the spectrum analyzer sweeps from 100 megs to 200 megs, in my example, the tracking signal generator is also sweeping from 100 megs to 200 megs. Now that sweeping signal generator attached to and part of that spectrum analyzer could act a little bit like a network analyzer. In most cases, that would be a scalar network analyzer. It would be creating a sweeping signal that I would apply to the input of an amplifier. The output of the amplifier would go to the spectrum analyzer displaying what signals are coming out. And so amplitude-wise, I'd know what I want to know. A network analyzer is very similar to that, but there's a catch. And that is, not only is there a built-in sweeping tracking signal generator, but the tracking sweeping signal generator has a very clearly defined phase relationship with the spectrum analyzer response. And the spectrum analyzer that's built into a network analyzer has something called a synchronous demodulator. It is a phase-sensitive demodulator. It has a so-called in-phase and out-of-phase component. This is as deep as I'm going to go. But it is a network analyzer is a couple of steps beyond a spectrum analyzer. A true network analyzer is carefully measuring the phase of the response as well as the amplitude of the response, and it knows the phase of the signal, it applied to the signal. So could you add a sweeping SIGGEN to a spectrum analyzer and get halfway toward a network analyzer? Yes. Could you use a network analyzer as a spectrum analyzer? There's sort of a yes to that, but there's one more catch. Let me drop. And the catch is that a network analyzer has a, you could call it a tracking signal generator along with a tracking network analyzer to it, but there's a catch, and that is the network analyzer looks at only the fundamental component of what's coming out of the amplifier. The magic of the way its synchronous detector works is that at the instant it's applying a 150 megacycle signal to your amplifier being tested, the output network, the output of your amplifier is going into the network analyzer and it's looking for 150 megacycle signal only. If at that time that you apply a 150 megacycle signal, your amplifier was simultaneously creating a second harmonic of 300 megacycles, for the most part, the network analyzer would not see that. By way of careful analysis of the S parameters that you could measure, you'll have a clue that there is a second harmonic present, but under ordinary circumstances, it wouldn't do it. So as you can see, each of those two instruments, spectrum analyzer and network analyzer, each one has its strengths and weaknesses. If you want the whole story, you want to hook up your amplifier to both. And one last thing I'm going to mention.
Okay, I send the mic to me.
No, you're absolutely right. There was a delay in the machine. You're absolutely right in that the old-fashioned tube amplifiers that had a real tuning and loading control really were an antenna tuner built into that amplifier. Once we decided to have a no-tune amplifier in more compact transistorized circuits, the tuning and loading controls were removed. The good news is the amplifier is more compact and faster to use. The bad news is that now you've got a guarantee that your antenna has something like a 1.5 standing wave ratio or better. So we've gained and we lost when we went to these no-tune amplifiers. And now the manufacturer sells us back the antenna tuning network that used to be there, and we call it an antenna tuner. It's a separate purchase. And yes, you could take an antenna tuner, add your tube circuit to it, and make it into an old-fashioned amplifier with the real tuning and loading control. You could do that. We have to move on pretty soon, Wesley, so briefly I'm going to send it back to you for one more comment. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet. Then we'll come back to you later with the time that's left over. You got it, Wesley. Wesley, why don't you just talk over that noise?
Okay. N2XJN. Well, yes. Thank you very much. It is beautiful answer and beautiful explanation. The way you explain things, I believe, very, very easy for many ham radio operators. It's really educational. Now, I would like to encourage ham radio operators to build their own amplifiers. And the reason for that is, if you want to spend $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, and you can
repeater, time out, repeater,
fashion way, then how much are you going to spend for the tube? $200? And maybe $20 for the transformer, and then rectifying circuitry is very easy to do. It's educational, it's inexpensive, and also for many people thinking, what am I going to do with my time? It's a great adventure. That's my suggestion. Thank you very much, and I appreciate, and I'm sending the microphone to you back. And to Andrea.
Go over this. Me too, the answer again.
Very fine, Wesley. I agree with you. Nowadays, many of us are scared to death to build our own ham radio equipment. When Mel and I cut our teeth in ham radio in the mid-1950s, the vast majority of ham radio operators built their own transmitter. At least half of them built their own receiver. And we learned a lot in the process. Modern-day transceivers have such a large number of transistors and integrated circuits and microprocessors and whatever. It's now well beyond 95-98% of the ham radio operators to build their own transistor transceiver today. With one or two weeks salary, you can buy it. To build it yourself would take you at least a year of your labor, and the chances of success are not very good. However, we amateurs are extremely good at building our own antennas, and with a little bit of extra enthusiasm, we could do an extremely good job of building our afterburner amplifiers, our high-power final stage amplifiers. That's what Wesley is suggesting, and it's not as difficult as you think.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Not as difficult as you think. There's a good number of articles and website locations that'll tell you how to do it. So don't be turned off by that. You have to be a little bit careful. Many of these high-power amplifiers, if you're doing it with tubes, and I do recommend you do it with tubes, because it's about four times more difficult to do it with transistors. If you do it with tubes, it's a lot easier to understand. It's a lot more forgiving. You can take a tube amplifier and plug it into an open circuit because you forgot to connect the antenna or the transmission line, or a short circuit because you've got a failure in the cable, and the tube circuit, for the most part, will laugh at you when you do that. No problem. You do that with a transistorized circuit, and you're probably going to go out and buy a new final stage transistor. They can only tolerate that kind of misuse for about a millisecond, if you know what I mean. The good news is they're compact. So the tube amplifiers are much more forgiving, much more easy to understand, easier to build, but the one catch is you're probably operating with 800, 1500, 2000 volts, and so on. You got to be careful with the high voltage. You got to obey some very good safety rules. I wonder if you have any further comments on that, Mel, before we go on. I bet you built quite a few amplifiers. I bet you've helped.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'll bet you've helped a few of the guys in Brooklyn to build their amplifiers. So, now my guess is you would also recommend that there's a lot to be said about building your first amplifier out of tubes as opposed to transistors if it's a high power type. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, this is K2KEY. All right. Final word on spectrum analyzers. First of all, a network vector analyzer. My friend bought one from Array Solutions, a company called Array Solutions. Very reasonably priced. Hooks it to his laptop, and it does kilobuck actually work. I mean, this thing performs magnificently. We were doing an evaluation on a filter with it, and I was just thrown back how well this thing performed, as well as any I think you could buy for maybe 10 times or 20 times the price. So if you're really interested in going further, look into a unit called made by Array Solutions. All right, now, as far as building, yes, amplifiers. Most people picture, when you talk about building an amplifier, linear amplifier, they, you know, picture kilowatt in the kilowatt class. But I don't suggest that to get your so-called feet wet. You can get a couple of old tubes that are around, plenty of them, and there's so many around that are
repeaters. Time out. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, this is K2KY again. You can build yourself a nice little amplifier. For instance, you have a QRP rig. And at times you just want at the home station, you know, get that little extra kick. You've got a QRP rig and you'd like to go, say, from QRP, go up 10 times the power, get a 10 dB gain. So what to do? You could build yourself a very simple amplifier. It could be even just a one-tube amplifier. Plenty of these tubes I see, such as old tubes, such as, you look them up, you'll see them in ham sets, such as tubes like 807, 6L6s, etc. Six said when we cut our teeth, these were common tubes. Power supplies and all, it's very straightforward. You don't have to deal with the huge voltages, you know, in the thousands of volts. So, and the components, of course, are more reasonable on the output components, coil, tuning capacitor, etc. Gives you a good place to start, and you'll get a lot of gratitude out of it, taking that little QRP rig and now bringing it up to a point where it will be, you know, a great functioning radio
repeater. Time out. Repeater. Time out. Cancel.
Very fine, Mel. Mel used the word QRP a number of times. To the new people joining, That's the three-letter abbreviation. There's a whole lot of three-letter abbreviations that came about in the days of Morse code, where many of the three-letter abbreviations begin with the letter Q. And they chose the letter Q, I think, because it is a very rarely used letter of the alphabet. So QTH means where are you located. QSL means you're going to send me a card. QRP means I'm running low power, usually under 5 watts. So a QRP ham radio operator is a ham radio operator using less than 5 watts of power. QRO means I'm going to increase my power. I'm going to become a big gun, a high power operator. There's about 100 of those Q signals. And so it's kind of fun to learn those. The next person who signed into the TechNet was Joe. Haven't heard from him for a little while. He's been kind of quiet for a few weeks. What's the latest in your neighborhood, Joe? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. A simple question, actually, had to do with AM radios installed in cars. I noticed that some of these antennas on these more modern vehicles that have an outside antenna, you know, full-length antenna, like 39-inch, they seem to have like a wire that's wound around the outside metal mass itself in a very slow spiral type of action. Is there any way of improving that actually improve AM reception and get a little better reception out of that length antenna? Back to you.
I think the answer might be no, Joe. In the case of the, I think you're describing, first of all, it's a kind of a whip antenna that used to be used in the old days on cars, which was a simple E-field probe. I mean, when you're down at 1 megacycle, where the wavelength is 300 meters, which is, what, 900 and some odd feet long, the little whip antenna you've got at that frequency is extremely small. You know, it's 1 degree long. It's a thousandth of a wavelength, so to speak. And as such, to resonate that is very, very difficult. The antenna, when you do succeed in resonating, it becomes essentially an E-field probe. It's looking at the local E-field and amplifying it and sending it to the rest of the circuitry. Nowadays, almost all of our AM radios, let me drop, have the antenna built into the windshield, because the whip antenna that used to come out of the fender of the car, eventually it would fail, it would be broken off, people would vandalize it. For a while there used to be a motor that would make it stick up, and every time you turn the key off in the car it would retract itself and go back inside. Well, that can only go through a certain number of operations before it fails. So now that we've got the antenna built into the windshield, it's a much more robust antenna mechanically, but electronically it's nowhere near as good as you would like, because you're now building a kind of a dipole-like thing. Many of the windshields, if you study them, they've got two little wires coming up the center of the windshield, sort of like twin lead, which break out and go to the left and to the right on the top of the windshield, sort of like a dipole. And the manufacturer has done the best he can to resonate that particular antenna at your AM frequencies. And the AM really is a vertically polarized signal. And I think you're asking, what can you do to improve the performance of that? Good. I think you're asking, could you put an antenna on the outside of the car to make it work better? I know that Wesley wants to say something, but let me, before we go too far with this, sometimes I misunderstand the question, Joe, so let me understand, is that your real question, that you've got an antenna built into the windshield and you would like better AM or FM performance out of that antenna? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
No, that's not what I said at all. Not even close. I didn't say anything about an antenna in a windshield. I said an antenna that's mounted on the fender, well, mounted on the car that resembles a 39-inch length mast, which is basically typically, I don't know, a quarter wafer FM broadcast, something like that. Something in that range. And they typically, what I've seen with a few of them, they take a spiral of wire and wound it around the outside. The entire thing is rubber coated. I thought if I added more wire, I could make the thing actually start resembling a ferrite type of inductor, and it would give me a little better performance on AM broadcast. That's what I was getting at.
Comment, N2RSO.
And where's the N3C?
Wesley and RSO both recognized. I'm going to give an answer first and then turn it over to those two guys in sequence. I think the answer is no. Go ahead and try it, Joe. But I give you a long shot there. It's a fairly dark horse. The antenna itself, you called it quarter wave. It is far from quarter wave. At 1 megacycle, which is the middle of the AM band, which is 300 meters wavelength, which is almost 1,000 foot is the wavelength, and your antenna is 1.5 feet long, so to speak. It's 0.001, 0.0015 of a wavelength. And if you think you're going to resonate that by winding tight a wire, I doubt it. The problem with a full performance antenna with maximum bandwidth and best impedance match is you would like the antenna to mechanically be approximately a quarter wavelength long as a ground plane with a great big ground plane, multiple wavelengths in size. Your car ain't anywhere near big enough. That piece of wire is nowhere near a quarter wavelength, so you're nowhere near resonant.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You're nowhere near mechanically resonant. Electronically resonant, now you're going to make that circuit as lossless as you can make it, and you're going to give it a good impedance match. And the so-called infinitesimal section of any of the good antenna handbooks will lead you to believe that you lose less than half a dB. When you properly resonate an antenna and make it infinitesimal in length, that antenna is infinitesimal. So as long as your impedance matching network is lossless, you can have within half a dB full performance of a full size antenna. I know that's not easy to believe. The best performance improvement you can do would be to disconnect the radio from the instrument panel, find the place where the RF tracking takes place, expand your antenna to the right position, and double check that at your favorite frequency on AM performance, rock that tracking control, the RF tuning control, and to confirm that the RF tracking of that amplifier, the front end amplifier, is tracking the frequency you're now tuned to. Because if it is this track, and you're getting 10 dB.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Everyone be aware that the timer is much shorter in timing tonight. It usually is set 2 or 3 minutes. I think it's set less than 1 minute. So we got to be careful. So the tracking control, in my opinion, is the biggest place where you're going to get performance improvement. Go ahead and experiment with tighter winding of a rubber duck-like antenna. And you think that electronically you're going to achieve more length. When you make any electronic change to the antenna, you will have to do a retracking of that front-end amplifier. That front-end amplifier has a tracking circuit that must track, because electronically the tuning must be readjusted as you go from the high end of the dial to the low end of the dial, because that antenna is so short. No way in hell can that antenna span the whole frequency range of 0.5 to 1.5 megacycles, your AM band. So the tracking is the biggest variable, in my opinion.
I agree.
Let's see what Wesley's got to say. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Oh, it's a very simple answer for that. Yes, you can resonate that circuit, and the easy way to do it is you actually take a coil, connect to this antenna or whatever windshield, whatever you want. The number of winds in that coil has to be a certain length that gives you kind of the shortening of the wavelength that you want to achieve, and you put your Sirius network with the capacitor. You put the small, that capacitor has the ability to actually be regulated. Now you're covering the whole band of the AM. Am I right or am I wrong? Back to you.
Quebec, Golf, Zulu.
Quebec, Golf, Zulu. We're going to get to you after Frank. We got three people on the line here. No. No way in hell. No matter what you use for an antenna covering 0.5 to 1.5 megacycles, an antenna of high performance, of such small physical size, cannot possibly scan the whole band without electronic retuning.
What you're doing is you have your variable capacitor. What you're doing is tuning your circuit. You can go from 500 kilohertz up to 1550 kilohertz. And if you make that network wide enough, you can have it. I don't believe that. I don't buy it thick.
The tuning you're talking about is tuning the antenna. The radio does that automatically. There is a tracking circuit in the front end of that radio that tunes that antenna depending on where you have set the dial on the radio. I am reasonably sure, I would bet a fair amount of money, Leslie, that any reasonable design of high performance for the AM band is not likely to be made thoroughly broadband where no electronic tuning is required when you go from 0.5 to 1.5. That's a 3-to-1 frequency range.
Do you remember the old ferrite antennas with the coils on it and the capacitor on it, and they were able to tune the AM frequency? I put your radio on the certain frequency, or adjust your antenna, and you're going to get the signal. And I'm sure about it.
PZ with a comment.
Stand by. We've got four guys already piled up. That ferrite loop stick radio, that transistorized handheld radio that you've used, how many variable capacitors are on that front end that you're change the dial, Wesley? There are two separate capacitors and sometimes three. One of them is
the 70 picofarads of the one capacitor that was covering the entire band.
There is a variable capacitor tuning that antenna as you tune the dial. You were electronically tuning that ferrite rod, and it was tracking the frequency you were tuned to. The antenna itself did not instantaneously cover the whole band. Do you disagree with that? Wait for the beep.
Radios that were designed working only on the AM, there was one antenna with two or three coils on the ferrite, but it was one 450 or 470 picofarad variable capacitor. So all you got to do is take your ferrite, take two coils if you want to do it this way, or just take the coil that is long enough and you actually shortening the way that this antenna electrically, the efficiency suffers. But with the few kilowatts of power of the AM station, is not going to really be noticeable. And I'm sure about 100%, you do it, you're going to get it. You just put your radio on a certain frequency and adjust the capacitor. Done.
Okay, let me ask you a direct question, Wesley. You and I have a difference of opinion here. When you took that ferrite loopstick transistorized radio that you and I used in our youth, when I tuned it to the low end of the band at 500, and then I tuned to the high end of the band, 1500, and there was a ganged, multiple, variable, air-tuned capacitor. One portion of that variable-tuned capacitor connected to the front-end dial changed the local oscillator. Another ganging of that variable capacitor was directly connected to one of the coils across that ferrite loop stick, tuning the ferrite loop stick with me as I tuned across the dial. That ferrite loop stick at any instant of time covered only a small region around the frequency I'm tuned to. If I tuned to the 1 megacycle signal, that ferrite loop stick only operated plus or minus 10 kilohertz from 1 megacycle. When I tuned to the low end of the dial, the two portions of that variable capacitor connected to the front end dial both moved. The ferrite had to be retuned, as well as the oscillator
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yes, you're right. You're right. In this portion, you're right. The thing is that you remember the old time. You look at this capacitor, it was 3 or 4 sections of this capacitor, and you had a small switch that you could actually add the capacitance of that. So, actually, it's a very small device. You can take this few sections on it, and then all you need is just a switch. Am I right?
I'm getting you to slowly agree that you have to change the tuning of the ferrite rod when you change the frequency. Up till now, you're saying that if we properly set the tuning and loading, the antenna will cover the whole. I say the antenna will not cover the whole band all at once.
It will not cover the whole all at once. Never. Impossible to be done. What I'm saying is that I was done within probably 15 minutes, and it's going to work. So you have a few sections of one capacitor. Each one has a certain capacitance, and then if it's not enough, you don't have to retune the coil on the ferrite. All you got to do is have a switch. You can switch either the capacitor, you can switch the inductance. Back to you.
K6DPZ, make one comment. K6DPZ. The next person in line was Frank. into RSO. Go ahead, Frank. Do you believe that the ferrite loop stick or the front end antenna of any antenna that's a whip on the fender